People often ask me how I got started as a speaker on leadership on the international speaker circuit. Like so many developments in my life, this one had more than a little serendipity to it. One morning, I got a call from someone who said she was from YPO, which was amusing to me because YPO is an acronym for my youth orchestra at the time, the Youth Philharmonic Orchestra. It turned out that YPO also stood for the Young Presidents Organization, an association of presidents of corporations who are under the age of 50. They meet regularly to discuss business matters and, most importantly, to learn from each other and from experts in many fields, not just business. Periodically, YPO holds a major meeting for a large gathering of corporate presidents, sometimes as many as 2,000, for what they call a university. The next one was to be in Boston. The phone call was to ask if I would be interested to come and talk about music. I actually wasn't very interested. I have to admit, I was somewhat prejudiced against business types, having had next to nothing to do with the business world. But when I heard the roster of speakers who were going to be at the event, Julia Child, President Bok of Harvard, Cicely Tyson, the film star and former wife of Miles Davis, among many others, I was intrigued. As it turned out, I had been gathering my thoughts about an issue in the classical repertoire that I was interested in sharing, but never in my wildest dreams would it have occurred to me that I might gather a group of businessmen with whom to share them. The issue was a remarkable fact that I had discovered that certain pieces in the classical repertoire, very well-known pieces, had been misrepresented in performance. I thought that the blindness that comes from unfounded assumptions might make a good theme for corporate leaders. I agreed and planned out my talk, getting more engaged as the date approached. On the day, I was told to go to the White Bar in the Marriott Hotel in Boston, where I sat, waiting for the 1 o'clock start time. 1 o'clock struck, and not a single person had entered the bar. Not one. I was not best pleased. Around 1:10, I packed up my materials and was about to leave and walk out on what turned out to be one of the biggest opportunities of my life, when Susan rushed in a flutter of profuse apologies. "I'm so sorry," she said. "We forgot to put your talk in the book, so no one knew it was taking place." We settled in one of the booths and I told Susan about what I had planned to reveal. I talked about the Danse Sacrale from Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, where a girl dances herself to death as a sacrificial act at a tempo quite unsuitable to the task. The end of the Shostakovich Fifth Symphony, whose true meaning had been hidden in a secret message from Shostakovich to the West. And Beethoven's Ninth, where two crucial passages of the work had been misunderstood for over 200 years because of two simple clerical errors by Beethoven's nephew. As the story unfolded, Susan became more and more engrossed until I saw her wipe a tear from her eyes. "If I can get a group for tomorrow, would you be willing to come back and tell this story?" The next day was complicated. It was Thursday, the Boston Philharmonic rehearsal night. We had a particularly awkward rehearsal on the docket. We had recorded Beethoven's Ninth, and a British recording company, IMP Pickwick, had agreed to issue it because of its revolutionary take on the tempi. But I had come to the conclusion that the recording would not do. It lacked the absolute conviction that I felt it required, and some of the tempi went quite right. And moreover, there was one note that had been played wrongly by everybody since Beethoven's time. How could I put out yet another recording with that wrong note? What was needed was to start again, to re-record. I was going to present this to the orchestra at the next rehearsal, and we were going to see if the orchestra would be capable of raising their game another level to justify the cost of another recording. The day of that rehearsal was the very day that Susan had asked me to give a talk at 5 p.m. to a group of business people. Well, if you can gather enough interested people, I'd consider it, I replied. What would you consider enough? Oh, say 30 or 35? The next morning, I found that 150 had signed up, and further, we could take them all in 5 buses to the rehearsal hall of the New England Conservatory for the rehearsal. I saw with growing excitement that it would be possible to kill 2 birds, or in this case, 150 birds, with 1 stone. I'll talk to them for an hour, and then we'll go to Brown Hall and watch the orchestra rehearse a piece I will be discussing in the talk. One thing you can always rely on with YPO is that they will do anything to provide their members with out-of-the-box, unique and memorable experiences without regard to effort or cost. I gave the talk for an hour about Beethoven, Stravinsky and Shostakovich, at the end of which 150 presidents, now all fired up and ready to go, piled into the buses and were driven to the conservatory on Huntington Avenue. They obviously expected to sit in the banked seats in the audience, but I told them to take a folding chair and put it somewhere among the players in the orchestra, wherever they could find a space. And then I told them that as soon as the music started, they would have to stay absolutely quiet. I said that the stakes were sky high for the decision to be made that evening. And of course, I hoped that the presence of all the high-powered leaders from all over the world would inspire the players in the orchestra to reach deep into their technical and emotional resources. Somewhere, I have a letter from one of the YPO members saying something to the effect, I have climbed in the Himalayas, I have been in a bucket hanging from a tall building, I have done deep sea diving, nothing has compared to the experience of sitting in the middle of the second violins during the rehearsal of Beethoven's 9th. At one moment, I remembered I stopped the rehearsal and said, the thing that may look strange to you is that I'm not actually conducting what's happening. I'm conducting what is about to happen. Just like when you are leading your company, you are not leading what's happening. You're ahead, leading what is about to happen. There were a few other moments in which I stopped to draw some parallels between conducting an orchestra and conducting a company. It wasn't exactly rocket science, but apparently it caught their fancy. The playing that evening was gobsmacking. For whatever reason, it was at quite a different level from the previous recording. Perhaps it was the presence of all those corporate leaders sitting right beside them, eager to learn and absorb the message of passion, struggle, and triumph that is Beethoven. Anyway, the die was cast. The re-recording would go forward. At the break, I got 3 invitations to speak to different companies in far-flung parts of the world. Oh, and a very friendly Canadian gentleman came up to me and said, how much would you guess it would cost to re-record that one note? Oh, I don't know, I said, maybe $5,000. Okay, he said, and right there he wrote out a check for $5,000. We dedicated the note to him. It's written in the CD booklet. The Brennan Note. After the rehearsal, I joined a group of them for dinner, hosted by a man who became a very important figure in my life over the next many years. Tony Buzan, author of many books on the mind and one of the most innovative thinkers of the day and the inventor of mind mapping. During the dinner, he invited me to come to Brussels the following month to give a talk for a conference of business leaders. What shall I talk about? Just what you did this evening, he replied. He said the fee would be $60,000 with first-class flights and all expenses paid. I had leapt with a single bound into a totally different world, a world of high fees and devoted appreciation. I realized with amazement that in this new world, in some sense, we musicians had more to offer to the business people than they had to offer us. They knew how to make things, and especially how to make money, but they couldn't easily get access to the soul, to passion, to love, to expression, and matters of the heart, yes, to possibility. This is what they wanted more than anything for their employees, for their families, and above all, for themselves. I knew nothing about business, but I knew Beethoven and Bach and Mahler and Chopin, and also how to infuse musicians with enthusiasm and energy and to release their own passions and joys. That's what those presidents wanted above all else. Ross and I immediately settled down to codify what we had discovered about the energy and attitude we call possibility. It later became our book, The Art of Possibility, which has been translated into 22 languages. We were able to bridge the gulf between music and business, between the right and left brain, and between the practical and the spiritual in such a way that it could inspire even the most jaded business types and remind cynical musicians why they had gone into music in the first place. Possibility, we decided, describes a way of being, open, curious, active. It also calls upon the observer in each one of us to notice when we are making unproven assumptions, as I did when I assumed that business people wouldn't be interested in what I had to say about music. It's definitely a disciplined way of being. We saw that one drop of downward spiral expression can spoil a gallon of pure possibility, because it is a betrayal of trust. If you say to your lover, "I'm so happy that you've come into my life," and you follow that with "but," you've totally destroyed the truth of your original expression. From then on, I received a steady stream of invitations, sometimes as many as 5 a month, to the far corners of the earth to speak to every kind of group, to business leaders, to religious organizations, to schools, hospitals, and 5 times to leaders at the World Economic Forum in Davos. The message always was leadership and possibility. The means was music. Every event ended with the whole crowd, however large, on one occasion 14,000 people at an evangelical Christian conference, singing on top of their voices the Ode to Joy in German, "Alle Menschen werden Brüder," all mankind will be as brothers, as if they were determined to do whatever it took to make it happen. If I had walked out of the White Bar at the Marriott at, say, 7 minutes past 1 o'clock instead of at 10 past, I probably never would have become an internationally known public speaker, able to support countless students and musical enterprises, make 20 commercial recordings, and buy a wonderful house on Brattle Street in Cambridge. You're probably wondering what I told the presidents from YPO in that hour before we got into the buses. I didn't talk about possibility at all. I didn't even talk about leadership. I hadn't even thought about that then. I told them about 3 pieces of music that people had come to accept or assume should be played differently than the composer had intended. And then I allowed them to experience the shock when the original intention was revealed. Let's experience that again. In the late summer of 1989, I got a package containing a cassette tape and a note. The note read, "Listen to this, Bill." It was a recording of The Rite of Spring of Stravinsky, and the note was from Bill Malik, a maverick musicologist and friend. Knowing that the BPO was about to prepare its first performance of the Rite for the upcoming season, he sent a tape of a rendition of the Rite of Spring for pianola, an upright piano designed to play piano rolls, which had been supervised by Stravinsky himself. I settled down to listen to it, fascinated by the sound of the pianola and by the amount of subtlety that the pianist, Rex Lawson, could get from a very mechanical process which I still to this day don't fully understand. Nothing about the interpretation struck me particularly until it got to the final section, the danse sacrale. It literally took off like a bat out of hell. What? It was about 30 points on the metronome faster than the rather sedate 126 that I had become used to listening to Stravinsky's several recordings and that of many other conductors too. I called up Bill. What on earth happened? His theory, simply put, was that Stravinsky's original conception was to dramatize in music the frantic, harrowing leaps and spasms of a young virgin literally dancing herself to death. Stravinsky actually claimed that he hadn't composed the piece at all. He said it had come to him as if from a force outside of himself. So when he came to put down on the pianola roll the danse sacrale, he did it at the tempo of his original conception. But the players who played it couldn't come close to bringing it off, nor could he conduct it. So he reduced the tempo to one that the players could manage and that he could conduct. It was a daring theory, but how could one possibly know that what we were hearing on the piano roll was what he had actually intended? Well, this is what Stravinsky wrote about his intention in making the piano rolls of all his early ballets around 1920. This is what he wrote. In order to create a lasting document which should be of service to those executants who would rather know and follow my intentions than stray to irresponsible interpretations of my musical text. And no ambiguity there. Also, at the time, Stravinsky had a studio upstairs in the Pleyel factory where the pianola rolls were made, so he would certainly have supervised the process very carefully indeed. Here is the last minute of the final section of the danse sacrale played on the pianola that I heard in my living room and that the young presidents heard that day at the Marriott Hotel in Boston. To me, by far the most compelling evidence for Bill's theory was the very first recording of the work conducted by Pierre Monteux, who had led the famous premiere in 1913, which had dissolved into a full-scale riot. This is the 1929 studio recording conducted by Monteux, going for broke at a tempo very nearly as fast as the piano roll. It is a surprisingly messy performance, given that it was played by the best professional musicians of the day and conducted by a man who was close to Stravinsky and had actually been the conductor of the premiere. It shows how incredibly difficult this music was for the players when it first appeared. But there's no doubt that the conductor is trying to create the frantic rush of a true sacrificial dance.
Thank you.
And now Stravinsky himself, conducting a similar orchestra with probably many of the same players, also in 1929 in Paris, but this time at the slower, safer tempo that he finally settled on to mark in the score, and that most conductors have dutifully followed to this day. Everyone involved is clearly struggling to keep it together, as the whole thing teeters on the brink of chaos. The thing that probably pushed me over into accepting what was on the piano roll must have been what Stravinsky had in mind was the vivid description of Madame Rambert, the great Russian ballet master, who lived in Ladbroke Grove in London and was a friend of my parents and someone I saw several times. She had danced in the first performance in 1913. This is how she described a scene at one of the rehearsals. Hearing the way that the music was being played, Stravinsky blazed up, pushed aside the fat German pianist, and proceeded to play twice as fast as we'd been doing it, and twice as fast as we could possibly dance. He stamped his feet on the floor and banged his fist on the piano and sang and shouted. Well, the die was cast. I had to do it. I announced in September to the musicians of the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra that we would perform Le Sacre in May and handed out the parts for the Danse Sacrale. We practiced a little each week from September to May. Next, you'll hear the whole Danse Sacrale from that performance in Jordan Hall on May 5th, 1990, the first time that we played through the whole piece and the very first time that anyone had heard it at the tempo of Stravinsky's original conception. You can really imagine at that galvanizing speed the young girl dancing herself to death, whereas at the traditional slower tempo, she seems to have a chance to survive. I wish Stravinsky could have heard that performance. I'm sure he would have embraced it as the truth. So staggering is its impact. When this recording came out in 1992, it was named by John Rockwell, the chief critic of the New York Times, as one of the 10 most important musical events of the year. It was also mentioned in the Penguin Guide to the best CDs and praised by critics around the world. Just a note before you listen. Find your best earphones and play the volume as high as you dare, just this once. Close your eyes and imagine that girl dancing herself to death. Thank you. When I was a cellist in my 20s, my mother often said, "Ben, you should be a conductor." "Oh, Mum," I would complain, "that's ridiculous. You have no idea how difficult it is to be a conductor. There's no way I could ever do that." It was an ongoing battle between us. When I went to pick up the recording of The Rite of Spring from I.M.P. Pickwick, my first recording ever, I went straight to Hampstead Cemetery and laid a copy on my mother's grave. "Thanks, Mum," I said, and I meant it. Many years later, the Boston Philharmonic Youth Orchestra went to Carnegie Hall with The Rite of Spring on a program together with Mahler's First. Thinking back to the struggle and near chaos of the musicians of the earliest recordings of the Rite, it's really extraordinary to reflect on what has happened to the accomplishment and love in our younger generation of aspiring musicians. Now, listen to a performance of this wildly difficult section of music played by kids aged 12 to 21. The second work I discussed with the young presidents that evening was the end of Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. When I began rehearsing the symphony for the first time, I discovered a very strange thing. The tempo marked in my score and the parts for the very last section was quite different from the one I was used to. What had happened? Well, in 1936, Shostakovich had been publicly castigated in the state-run press for his opera Lady Macbeth by no less a music critic than Joseph Stalin himself. Like so many artists, he lived in terror for his safety, even his life. Each night, he sat near the front door with his overcoat on and a packed suitcase, waiting for the secret police to come because he didn't want the children to be woken. He abandoned the planned performance of the Fourth Symphony that, with his harsh dissonances, he feared might seal his fate. Instead, he wrote the Fifth with the stated purpose of restoring his reputation in the eyes of the authorities. Of course, it had to end triumphantly as a celebration of the Soviet state. Nothing less would satisfy the Politburo, and indeed that is what it appeared to do. D major tonality, blaring trumpets and drums, joyful, rapid, repeated notes in the strings and winds, all the elements for an end in blazing glory. That was the way it was performed by everybody. The Politburo temporarily rewarded the composer's deference and the public rejoiced. Here is the famous performance by the New York Philharmonic under Leonard Bernstein, whipping up a froth of near hysterical enthusiasm to the inevitable standing ovation at twice the tempo that Shostakovich had marked in his score. What Shostakovich had marked in the score was eighth note equals 184, an extremely slow tempo. Yes, the musical elements were triumphant, but the effect was the opposite. Here is the performance of the end played by the Boston Philharmonic. It was almost certainly being heard for the first time anywhere at the composer's intended tempo and revealing the true meaning of the work. Hidden in a secret message from behind the Iron Curtain in the metronome mark. Shostakovich rightly assumed the authorities wouldn't notice, but nor apparently did the interpreters, assuming that the circumstances called for a triumphant paean of praise to Soviet socialism. I'll never forget that the first trumpet, Tim Morrison, now one of America's finest trumpet players, came to me after the performance and said, referring to the lip-busting stratospheric trumpet parts played at Shostakovich's punishing slow tempo, "God, Ben, I almost died." "I think that was the intended message," I replied. The third piece I discuss was the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven. I chose the two passages that have caused the most controversy amongst conductors, scholars, and music lovers. Of course, again, it concerned the tempo. The trio of the second movement has proved so problematical that most people have stopped trying to solve it. Actually, the matter is pretty straightforward. The scherzo, the second movement, is in three and is marked to be played at metronome dotted half note equals 116. The Italian marking is molto vivace. There is no controversy about this at all. Virtually every conductor takes the movement at that tempo or very close. There is no other tempo that would work. The trio, instead of having three notes in the bar, has four notes, but at the same tempo, 116. There's no intellectual problem with this idea. If you put a metronome on at 116 and then say 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, and then say 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4 at each click, you have Beethoven's idea. End of problem. In between the two sections is a passage marked stringendo, getting faster. It's like a bridge between two sections, so that the tempo of one gradually morphs into the second. It's a delightful solution, and it works perfectly. Now, listen to how this works. no problem, as the Americans say. But there is a problem, actually two problems. The metronome mark has a mistake. I explain what it is and why it happened in my discussion disc for Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Quite simply, Beethoven's nephew Karl, who was noting down the numbers, got it wrong. It's hardly surprising, since the metronome was a new machine and he wasn't actually a professional musician. But that little clerical error, a half note instead of a whole note, set the world spinning out of control, causing serious musicians down the ages to doubt the very system of metronome marks themselves. A half note equals 1/16 cannot possibly be a presto. So conductors for generations have willfully ignored the metronome marks and chosen a tempo that has nothing to do with 1/16, and Beethoven's neat juxtaposition of 3 and 4 beats to a bar and chosen something totally different, but not Beethoven's. The editor of the very popular Dover score made the obvious adjustment, printing it correctly as a whole note, but conductors the world over have rejected it as preposterous. That brings us to the second problem. The world has become accustomed to the trio section sounding like a charming pastoral, and it's been reluctant to consider that Beethoven was actually writing a brisk, exhilarating march, which was the way a critic described it at the first performance. The great oboe player of the Philharmonia said to me on the first day of rehearsal, "I can't do it at that tempo, or at least I can't play it musically." Well, of course, he could, and he did. The other passage I talked about with the young presidents was the march in the finale. It's just as notorious, but much less controversial. To get a full dose of the exciting knowledge surrounding this great passage, please go to the full discussion disc in the Beethoven section of this website. In short form, this is what happened. Again, Karl was at fault. Beethoven, in the conversation book, where he noted the tempi, wrote 84/68. You can see it clearly at the bottom of the page on the left. Nothing is said as the meter referred to. It was Karl who added the dotted quarter instead of the obviously intended dotted half when the letter with the metronome marks was sent off to the publisher's shot. Allegro assai vivace is a very fast tempo, and clearly 84 to a dotted quarter cannot possibly be right. Moreover, the words, "just as his sons hurtle through the glorious universe, so you, brothers, should run your course joyfully like a conquering hero," clearly suggest a hurtling tempo. Many conductors have recognized that this must be a mistake, but few have tried to realize anything close to Beethoven's actual tempo. I have yet to hear one other than this that hits it on the head. Now, one last point. Whether the tempo is 84 to the dotted half or to the dotted quarter, of course, makes not a whit of difference to the marchers. Try this. Put your metronome on 84. Now strut around the room with a proud, buoyant gait, and you will be marching at the traditional festive march tempo that Beethoven knew so well and composed so often. The exuberant words and the dotted rhythms will put a broad smile on your face until you reach the wild battle scene when the strings go crazy and finally the chorus enters with the Ode to Joy in glorious 6/8 mode. The tempo for the ode, when it first appeared, da 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 dee, da da da, was 80. Here it is 84. Did Beethoven want to elevate the tempo up a notch to put it into overdrive for this unforgettable moment? Or was it just a coincidence? One thing you can be sure, he definitely had a tempo in his mind right there. Here's the Alla Marcia. As you can imagine, by the time the 150 young presidents entered Brown Hall that Thursday evening, they were psyched and excited. Yes, about sitting in amongst the players, watching this enthusiastic fellow lead a rehearsal on Beethoven, but much more importantly, ready to be moved by the music, open to the idea that classical music, that strange, elusive form of communication that their parents and teachers had probably tried to get them interested in when they were kids, was actually a language that they could understand and be moved by. A world of passion and expressivity that could add to their left brain activities and give them, their families and their employees access to more emotion and more empathy than ever before. I became one of the most frequent speakers at YPO events, and I believe I was the only speaker who was ever invited 5 times as a keynote speaker at a YPO university, including 3 family universities involving hundreds of young children. It was through those experiences that I developed the notion, based on empirical evidence, that everyone loves classical music. They just haven't found out about it yet. You may remember that I mentioned that I was invited to speak at a conference in Brussels a month or so after the first meeting of the young presidents in Brown Hall. Well, on the way back to Boston, I stopped off in London to visit my father shortly before his death in his mid-90s. My brother Michael warned me, "Dad is not doing well. I would suggest 15 minutes is all he could take right now. Go back tomorrow for another 15 minutes on your way back to the airport." Whenever I asked my father in later life how he was, his reply was always with that slightly mischievous voice, somewhat reduced. It was no different this time. He was sitting in a chair which dwarfed him, with a woolen hat at an angle on his head. He was doing his best imitation of one of the Nibelungen dwarfs. My brother was clearly right about his state. After a general greeting, Dad asked, "Where are you coming from?" "Brussels," I replied. "What were you doing there?" he asked. "Giving a speech," I said. "What about?" By now, at least 4 minutes of the allotted time had elapsed. "Well," I began, wondering how I could encapsulate the extraordinary events that I had just experienced into a few minutes. "Well," I said again, and then I began to tell. About the choices in Possibility. About playing the final section of The Rite of Spring and Shostakovich and Beethoven Ninth. How we'd sung the Ode to Joy all together in German. And how one could choose the game of contribution instead of focusing on success and failure, winning and losing. I knew he was listening because although he was completely blind, he would occasionally raise his eyebrows. When I got to the end of the story, more than an hour later, he said, as he often did, enunciating the word with utmost clarity and with his still pronounced German accent lingering on the first syllable, "Fascinating." We sat quietly for a while. Then my father said, "Is there a tape of such a talk?" "Yes," I replied. A few minutes later, he said, "Do you have a tape with you?" "Yes," I replied. And then a few minutes later, "Could we listen to a bit of the tape?" I wondered if my brother would think I was being irresponsible, but I took out my Sony Walkman and put a pair of enormous headphones on his ears. I wish I could have taken a picture of this shriveled man with the black earpieces engulfing his whole head. He listened to the whole tape, and then he said a remarkable thing. "We didn't know anything else." What I think he meant was that he had been brought up in the Goethean philosophy, happiness lay in striving, work, and success. The reason I think he must have been thinking that is because of what he said next. "But if your life is about contribution, why would you work?" I replied, "There is no contribution in a mediocre performance of a Mahler symphony." I left Crowham Lee 2.5 hours after our conversation began. Mysteriously, unbelievably, possibility and music had kept my father engaged and alert, and so it has proved over and over. We've all had this experience. When the greatest music and possibility are involved, time seems to stop, and there is a deep healing power at play. A well-respected TV doctor, Christian Northrup, wrote in a review of The Art of Possibility that it was one of the most inspiring, practical, and uplifting books I have ever read. But what she wrote next is what's important. "The very act of reading it with an open heart and mind will improve your health."